Goose. Second, you labeled it lamb, which is totally illegal. How bad illegal? Yancey anticipated another bribe offer, and Brennan wasted no time, fishing a $100 bill from his back pocket. Pitiful, said Yancey. Put it away.
Don't shut us down again, Andrew. I got a kid in college.
Would that be the University of Cheech or the University of Chong? I know your boy, Brennan. He runs a grow house on Big Coppet.
Cut me some slack, man.
In truth, food mislabeling wasn't a serious enough offense to justify closing down a restaurant, even Stoney's. Yancey suspected that the serving of mongoose meat wasn't specifically mentioned in the state health codes. Lucky you caught me on a busy day, he said to Brennan.
I knew you was human.
Mary called Yancey from Fausto's Grocery, asking if he preferred Advil or Aleve. The night before, she'd flushed all his Percocets in an act of tough love. When Yancey got off the phone, Brennan presented a platter featuring a purplish wedge of mammal flesh scalded to the approximate texture of a roofing tile.
It's the last piece, Brennan said. Try a bite.
I'd rather slam my nuts in a screen door.
It ain't half bad, Andrew. Even better would be fried cutlets.
Yancey slapped the platter from Brennan's hand and walked outside. He looked up at the bluebird sky, wishing he'd worn his shades. Spending time with Benny the Blister had shaken Buck Nance's confidence in the superiority of the white male. He and his brothers had clung to such views since their Romberg youth, warped by their father's fulminations. While redneck stardom had exposed Buck to many white fans who were poor advertisements for a master race, Blister stood out as one of the worst specimens he'd ever met, stupid, reckless, dirty, and delusional. And that's when he was stone sober.
I can't believe we're in business with this maniac, Buck muttered to Coolman, while Blister took a cacophonous dump, the bathroom door wide open.
It's all good, said Coolman.
He killed a dude.
Keep it down.
And stabbed a damn cop.
Shh.
Where'd he come up with Spyro? That's not a bayou name, Buck griped.
Amp is properly freaked out. That's all that matters. A couple weeks from now, when the chopper I'm putting in your new contract lands at the rooster farm, you'll be making twice as much money as your backstabbing brothers.
And earning every damn dollar, said Buck.
Blister had warned them about the vicious new vibe on Bayou Brethren. Coolman wasn't surprised, but Buck refused to believe it until he saw for himself. They had screened the latest episode on a 60-inch plasma in the conch house Coolman had rented for them on Fleming Street. It was the day of the rough dinghy ride back to the mainland after Blister had sprung them from the handcuffs and sunk the wet nurse by disconnecting the seacock hoses. Buck had grown furious watching Junior, Buddy, and Cleroy badmouth him on camera. He immediately gave Coolman permission to contact John David Ampergroat and present the Spyro ultimatum. Blister was soaring, too dim to foresee the obvious. Coolman had no intention of casting a criminal on the show as his prize client's lost twin. Once Buck's rich new deal was finalized, Coolman planned to call Crime Stoppers and have Blister busted for the conch train killing. The network honchos wouldn't be upset. In fact, they'd be relieved because they wouldn't have to write an expensive new Nance into the storyline. Meanwhile, Coolman and Buck would stay mum about what happened on the boat. Putting Blister on trial for kidnapping would be counterproductive, keeping Buck in Key West at a time when his presence on the Brethren set would be crucial. Now, Coolman didn't need Hell Island or any other project in his back pocket. Buck's new deal was a lifetime score for both of them. The Nance Patriarch's scrappy rebound from disgrace and scandal would be the hottest show business story in America. At Lane's instruction, Buck had already phoned the sheriff to say he was alive and well and deeply sorry for all the fuss he'd caused. He promised to donate a truckload of Brethren swag to an auction benefiting the local kids' baseball league, which fully redeemed him in the eyes of Sheriff Summers. Buck's return to television was guaranteed to rack up monster numbers in prime time and on streaming internet. And as the architect of the celebrity redneck's triumphal comeback, Kuhlman would be more valuable than ever to platinum artists, possibly even more valuable than Amp. The only cloud on the horizon was Rachel, and Kuhlman was now considering an expedited divorce settlement before he got promoted and the serious dough began rolling in.
"Oh, no," he heard Buck say. "What the fuck?"
Blister was twirling a silver-plated semi-automatic that he'd stolen from a Mini Cooper outside the pier house after docking the dinghy. Kuhlman was scared of firearms, and Buck's own limited experience came from the TV tapings, when he and his brothers would pepper whiskey bottles or beer cans under the off-screen supervision of a former Marine sniper.
"Is that thing loaded?" Kuhlman asked Blister.
"Not totally sure, dude."
Buck calmly told him to put the gun away. Blister instead aimed it at the plasma screen, where one of the bad hairpieces on Fox News was offering insight on Ukraine.
"Just because I don't have my own lawyer," Blister said, squinting one eye, "don't mean those Hollywood Jews can screw me over on this deal. You boys got my back, right?"
Buck roared,
"Hell yes, brother!"
Kuhlman, struggling to hide his fear, nodded devotedly. Blister lowered the pistol.
"Now on, call me Spyro."
"I'm proud to have you as a client, Spyro. Big changes are coming your way. Good stuff, so get ready."
Kuhlman excelled at false enthusiasm, and Blister was swept along. That Kuhlman had persuaded the bonehead to uncuff them and abandon the wet nurse somewhat restored Buck Nance's faith in his agent. It had been Kuhlman who, upon learning of Blister's preposterous ambition to join the Brethren, conceived the lost twin concept. Blister was so excited about becoming a Nance that he'd allowed Kuhlman to purchase a new cell phone for the ostensible purpose of accelerating negotiations. The rental house on Fleming, paid for with the same platinum artist's Visa card, had been cleverly presented by Kuhlman as a luxury perk. Blister was ecstatic, even though the size of the place made it difficult to keep his eyeballs on Buck and his agent 24/7. Kuhlman believed that Blister would come to treat them less as captives and more as fellow players in the TV deal.
"Vanity always trumps common sense," Kuhlman had whispered to Buck. "First rule of Hollywood."
And sure enough, Blister seemed to be letting down his guard. He assigned Buck and Kuhlman the same upstairs bedroom, yet failed to secure the windows, so that escape via a poinciana tree was available if necessary. While the presence of the handgun was unnerving, Buck reminded Kuhlman that Blister had acquired it by chance, not design. The dumbass had been snooping mainly for loose cash and jewelry in the Mini Cooper. His unfamiliarity with the basic mechanics of firearms confirmed his preference for knives. In addition to not knowing if the semi-automatic was loaded, Blister had no idea what caliber it was. Buck hoped that, like most burglars, Blister would pawn the weapon at his first opportunity. Kuhlman was too jumpy to wait.
"You need to get rid of that thing ASAP," he told their kidnapper.
"How come? You're my agent, not my damn babysitter."
"Because if you get caught with a gun, our whole project's in the shitter. The network has a strict moral turpitude clause in every talent contract."
Blister sneered.
"What the fuck is moral turpentine?"
Kuhlman smiled painfully.
"Turpitude It means bad behavior, Spyro, such as drug use, sexual misconduct, or getting busted with a stolen firearm.
I don't plan on getting busted.
Still,
listen here. I've been thinking hard about my contract, said Blister. That man in California you've been talking with, what's his name again?
John David Ampergroat. He's the head of the whole agency.
I want to meet him.
Kuhlman sucked in a breath. Buck's expression turned grim. There's no need for a meeting, Kuhlman said to Blister. Mr. Ampergroat can overnight the paperwork directly to us.
No, I want to see the man. He thinks he's the shit, right? Well, I am the shit, and I need a handshake.
Buck Nance spoke up. Trust me, brother, that ain't how it works. Blister waggled the semi-automatic.
It works, however I say. How soon can he get here?
Kuhlman cleared his throat.
I'll make a call.
You do that.
Blister flipped the gun around in his hand and casually peered into the barrel.
I can't tell if that's a damn bullet down there or not.
Brock Richardson complained to the governor's office about the archaeologist who was blocking construction of his house on Big Pine Key. The governor kept a team of smooth-talking aides who were trained to appease aggrieved campaign donors, and one of them referred Richardson to the Department of State, which referred him to the Division of Historical Resources, which referred him to the section on compliance and review, where nobody was answering the goddamn telephones. Richardson left an acid message warning of imminent litigation, naively presuming that anyone at that invisibly low level of government knew who he was or gave a flying fuck. Deb found him in the bathroom, standing again with an upraised arm in front of the mirror. She said,
"Don't tell me it grew back. Maybe you should go easy with that stuff."
How about knocking first?
I'm not digging the visual, Brock.
It didn't grow back. This is a new one, he said.
In fact, it was the third dangly stem to have budded in his armpits. The other pale intruders had been sliced off and biopsied, no evidence of malignancy. Richardson's doctor was, nonetheless, concerned. The tissue formations were uncanny in their resemblance to the male reproductive organ. Mini dicks, the surgeon called them, eliciting a heartless chuckle from his nurse. Brock had confessed his Petrolux habit to Deb after she discovered a soft glide applicator in his DOP kit. She didn't bitch him out too much because their sex life had reignited in a spectacular way. Fucking cosmic, in her words. One night, gleefully appraising his unbound erection, she exclaimed,
"You could hang a rodeo saddle on that thing."
The manufacturers of Petrolux had replaced the product's pungent juniper infusion with a scent of country apple and discarded the original deodorant formula in favor of an additive that actually suppressed body reek. Deb wasn't merely approachable again, she was insatiable. Blinded by carnality, Richardson continued to slather on the dangerous hormone-infused goop several times a day. This, while his grave TV pitch, with its scroll of loathsome side effects, attracted more and more Petrolux victims to the lawsuit.
"There's nothing to worry about," he told Deb in the bathroom. "They're harmless skin tags."
"Then how come they look like penises?"
"Because that's all you're thinking about these days." He managed a suggestive leer. "I'll take full credit, too."
They dropped to the floor and made love ferociously, cracking two of the travertines. Once again, Richardson astounded himself. Afterward, in the shower, Deb returned to the subject of their dream house dilemma. She implored him to reach out to Trabeau.
"Have him send those goons back to Yancey and make him sell his house to us."
Richardson said,
I already talked to Martin.
You tell him we're in a hurry?
He knows, Deb.
With soapy fingers, Richardson probed his left pit, where the newest pygmy phallus had emerged.
She said, I like Yancey's lot better than ours anyway.
Why? His is smaller.
Something about the view. Can I borrow your conditioner?
Richardson was still upset that Deb had lost the diamond ring, but the subject was no longer a constant flashpoint. This he attributed to his resurgent libido. Nothing less than white-hot sex could soften a $200,000 grudge. He toweled off, dressed for golf, and called the Sandman in Key West.
What's the word, Martin? Sorry, Big Noogie says no. He needs his guys to stay in Miami.
Did you tell him I'll cover their gas, food, whatever? Yancey is balls out refusing to sell. He basically laughed in my face.
Trabeau said,
Those smart-ass types are hard to reason with. You've practically got to kill them.
How much would that cost?
Richardson was startled by his own words. Only a card-carrying nitwit would talk on the phone about hiring a hitman. He wondered if the Petrolux was starting to impair his judgment. All the blood rushing to his cock might be starving his brain.
Hey, it was just a joke, he told Trabeau. You know that, right?
The Sandman said,
Big Noogie's an important person. I don't want to take advantage of our friendship.
So what the hell do I do about Yancey? For real, I mean.
Trabeau could be heard sipping a beverage.
You told me you had guys of your own,
he reminded the lawyer.
Yeah, but they're not as good as your guys, the mob guys.
Maybe they don't need to be. Surprise is key.
The Sandman had a point, thought Richardson. Yancey wasn't hardcore, he was all talk. The club bouncers that Richardson occasionally employed might not be as experienced at assault as were seasoned mafia goons, but years in the National Football League surely had taught them how to locate a kidney with their knees.
I'm lining up my big Havana trip, Trabeau was saying. You want to come? Bring your darling Deb.
Some other time. We're still looking for that missing diamond.
Bummer, said Trabeau with a slurp. I can probably get you a sweet deal on a new one. Just tell me how many carats. Every bride's got to have a ring.
Only one to a customer, was Richardson's response.
Trabeau switched to what he thought was a cheerier topic, the Petrolux case.
Did you check out the photos of my rash? Gnarly, huh?
On the other end of the call, Richardson was peering disconsolately up the sleeve of his shirt.
You got off easy, he said to the Sandman.
Chapter 18. Yancey's passport arrived, the renewal expedited by an add-on fee he was happy to pay. He called Rosa in Norway to tell her he was coming. She said the temperature was 14 degrees, minus 20 counting the wind chill.
I don't care if the fjords freeze, he said.
Andrew, I'm not ready.
Stay at the butcher's. I'll book my own room.
This is a tranquil place, said Rosa. I love you, but you're not a tranquil guy.
I'll read Gandhi on the plane.
As Yancey was talking, Mary Mansfield appeared at the doorway, lifted her top, then danced away.
Stabbing victims shouldn't travel, Rosa said.
I'll be fine once I'm there. You're a doctor, remember?
Slow down.
Tell me what's going on.
There was a discouraging pause. Yancey half expected her to say she'd found a new boyfriend. He thought, please God, anyone but the ski instructor.
Rosa said, You're right. It's got nothing to do with your damn stitches. I care about you. That's not up for debate.
but I need to keep a distance from the turbulence you create. For example, getting stabbed the way you did, you could have died, okay? Died in a pool of blood on the floor of some dirtbag's apartment, and then someone like me gets to come to the scene and haul away your dumb, dead ass. I'm not trying to be cold, but it's totally your fault you ended up in that ridiculously dangerous situation with that ridiculously dangerous person, all because you wanted to prove something to the sheriff, which, at this point, honestly?
Better spell it out. I specialize in clinging to false hope.
A calm sea is the best place for me right now, Andrew. So hurry up and solve your case. Then you can hop on that plane.
The case is a muck pit. I'm not getting anywhere.
You will. You always do. But don't come see me until you're finished. Promise? I need you to be totally tuned in.
She said goodbye without interrogating him about Mary, another ominous sign. He'd been hoping for signs of jealousy. Mary told him to quit moping.
For God's sake, I just showed you my tits.
And adorable they are.
Animal,
she snapped, then dissolved to a giggle when she saw his expression.
You don't know what to do with me, do you? I love that.
Yancey suggested a trip to town for a late lunch. On Highway 1, they spotted Mona pedaling a child's bicycle across the Cow Key Channel Bridge. The tires were almost flat, and a sad-looking cloth purse swung from a chain around her neck. Mary cruised ahead along South Roosevelt and pulled over at a motel to wait. As soon as Mona huffed past, Mary wheeled out and smoothly executed another leapfrog. In this way, they were able to track Blister's wife all the way to Fleming Street without hovering close and drawing attention. Mona stopped at a pretty two-story conch house with lavender shutters, a rope swing on the front porch, and a royal poinciana in the yard. After an inelegant dismount, she propped the bike against a picket fence and approached the front door. From down the street, Yancey and Mary could see her knocking with lumberjack vigor. The door opened, and she stalked into the house. Mary said,
"Call Burton and tell him where we are."
"I probably should."
"Like, immediately."
"I hear you," Yancey said. With Blister safely locked up, Yancey could be on a nonstop to Oslo tomorrow afternoon, drop Mary in South Beach on his way to the airport. He dialed Burton and got the voicemail.
"Hey, Raj, call me back as soon as you get this. I believe I've found your conch train killer."
While they waited, Mary told Yancey about an item she'd seen on page 6 of the New York Post.
"Katie Holmes went to Whole Foods, and they let her sneak in through a hidden passage. Isn't that fantastic? A grocery with a secret celebrity entrance. They should have one at Fausto's. Then, next time you send me for a gallon of milk and some Advil, except there probably won't be a next time, I could say, 'Sure, Andrew, I'll take the secret passageway.' That would be my dream, to just pop up like a genie in the produce aisle. Me and my Balenciaga."
Yancey said, "Who's Katie Holmes?"
"I will not let you burst my bubble. I refuse."
Mona came out of the conch house, mounted the bicycle, and briskly began pedaling down the street toward the spot where Yancey's car was parked. Mary said there wasn't enough room for a U-turn getaway.
"Pretend we're making out like lovers," she said, throwing both arms around Yancey's neck and kissing him in a way that didn't feel like she was pretending.
He thought it would be impolite not to kiss back. Mona sneaked a sideways glance as she rode past. There was the naughty trace of a smirk, but no sign of recognition. She had turned down Grinnell Street and disappeared from sight by the time Mary sat back and started fixing her hair.
"You okay, sport?" she asked.
"I would have to say yes."
Not a bad note to end on.
Except we're not quite done, said Yancey.
How dare you get bold with me?
No, look. A black limousine was pulling up to the Conk House. Mary identified it as the latest Cadillac Stretch, with front-wheel drive and a large V6.
You really need an 8, she added, but these fleet companies, they want the better mileage.
You drive limos, too? Yancey asked.
No, but I've done a few. Easy-peasy jobs. The chassis is so long that they don't fishtail when you hit the rear quarter panel. The chauffeurs are always super polite, too. Some wild redhead with a razor in her hand, shaving cream all over her cooch. Can you imagine what they must be thinking?
Only in Florida is what they're thinking.
I like to do limos, said Mary. Nobody gets overexcited.
Three men walked out of the house and climbed into the Stretch. First in line was Blister Krill. Next came Buck Nance, followed by his hotshot Hollywood manager, Lane Kuhlman. Yancey said to Mary, "Please don't smash my poor little Subaru into that caddy."
"Oh, please, your insurance'll cover it."
"Let's just follow them instead."
"The new Outbacks look super sweet," she remarked. "Or you could get yourself a Forester."
"Burton's going to call back any minute."
"Buckle up, Mario."
Yancey said, "That isn't funny. Not at all." Dominic Big Noogie Ayola brought his girlfriend Juveline to Key West along with Martin Trabeau's original bogus service dog, John. The missing Irish setter had reappeared at Crisco's restaurant soon after word went out that Big Noogie intended to dismember whoever had taken the animal from his town car. Although he wasn't a pet lover, Big Noogie tolerated John the dog because his girlfriend insisted. Her given name was Lucinda, but she'd called herself Juveline since age 15 when she'd been caught selling knockoff Burberry totes, and a cop at the booking desk misspelled the word juvenile. Big Noogie got them first-class bulkhead on the flight to Florida. Wearing a new orange vest, John the First snoozed at their feet. Having set aside his scorn for the comfort animal scam, Big Noogie had persuaded a psychiatrist in Crown Heights to write a letter documenting Juveline's emotional need for canine companionship while flying. The shrink had a ruinous gambling habit, so he leapt at the chance to assist Big Noogie, to whom he was monstrously in debt. The Sandman was waiting when Big Noogie got off the plane. He was surprised to see his ex-Irish setter leading the mobster down the jetway, and he felt a twinge of guilt about John the Second, the replacement fake service dog he'd set loose outside of Louis's. The feeling didn't last, for Martin Trabeau's attention was dangerously diverted by a woman accompanying Big Noogie. She was taller and owned many striking features— white blonde hair cropped like Annie Lennox's, full lips lacquered redder than Taylor Swift's, and a gravity-defying ass that was broad enough for a tray of mimosas. Trabeau forced himself to look away lest Big Noogie catch him gawking. When they arrived at the hotel, Juveline veered poolside with the dog, while Trabeau and Big Noogie discussed the Cuba deal over platters of fried seafood.
"So who's your Havana connection?" the mobster asked. "Deputy Minister of Coastal Resources."
Trabeau had come up with that one while he was in the shower. He didn't know a soul in the Castro government.
"What's he asking for a cut?" Big Noogie said.
25%.
"Fuck that in the ear. You tell him it's 18 now on."
"I'll try, Dominic, but he's a hard ass," Trabeau said.
His plan was to hang out in Havana until he located the appropriate bureaucrat to bribe. He was confident he could get all the beach sand he wanted in exchange for 12% of gross resale. Big Noogie wouldn't know the true spread and had no way of finding out. He couldn't join Trabeau on the trip because a judge was holding his passport pending resolution of a felony matter. Alleged felony.
I'll fly one of my guys down there with you, Big Noogie said.
Okay, but the Cubans got computers. Anybody with a rap sheet in the States is turned around at the airport and sent back.
Trabeau didn't know if that was true, but it was worth a shot. He assumed every person in Big Noogie's inner circle had an arrest record, and Big Noogie's scowl seemed to confirm it.
I can totally handle this alone, Trabeau assured him. It's what I do.
Remember when you were hanging upside down off of that bridge? How fucking scared you were? Next time you're shark food, you don't play this straight.
You think I'm out of my mind? I got the message loud and clear. Trust me, Dominic, we're going to clean up big time. Every tourist town on the eastern seaboard will pay serious bank for this sand. It's like cocaine for your toes.
Big Noogie chomped another conch fritter.
So where's the best shit in Cuba?
Better than what I put down behind your hotel? My man Sergio, the deputy minister, says it's mucho primo on the northern shore. He says there's easy access for our barges, but I'll check it out while I'm down there.
Trabeau ordered mojitos, and the two men raised a toast. Juveline appeared, body turbaned in a flamingo beach towel. She said John the dog was chowing down on a room service steak. Big Noogie passed his drink to her, saying,
I could do without the fucking mint.
She said, Noog, I just saw the biggest rat in the whole universe.
Trabeau chuckled.
At the pool?
No, on the seawall, chewing a mango.
She placed a hand at knee level to dramatize the creature's height. Big Noogie looked doubtful.
Even Bronx rats ain't that big.
Trabeau said it was probably an opossum. Juveline said,
I know what I saw. Both of yous can kiss my ass.
Trabeau was covertly checking out her enormous bare feet, pink as boiled hams. Juveline appraised him over the rims of Gucci shades.
When you leaving for Havana?
Big Noogie asked.
Soon as they okay my visa, I'll need some cash for expenses.
Trabeau didn't expect Big Noogie to say yes, but there was no harm in trying.
Pay your own damn way. You'll get it back when the deal's done.
Big Noogie handed a fritter to Juveline, who tore into it like a hyena. Trabeau thanked Big Noogie for sending his guys to rough up Brock Richardson's neighbor about the missing diamond ring.
Too bad they didn't find it, Trabeau said.
Yeah, too bad.
Can you believe that asshole won't sell his house? The neighbor I'm talking about, the ex-cop. Even after your guys totally trash his place, he tells my lawyer friend to fuck off. It's not for sale.
Some balls, said Big Noogie.
Obviously, the mobster didn't give a shit one way or the other, so Trabeau dropped the subject. After lunch, Juveline headed back to the seawall with a mission to photograph the mutant rat. Big Noogie was going deep-sea fishing, though he extended no invitation. Trabeau told him that Hemingway's marlin boat, the Pilar, was a popular tourist attraction in Cuba.
You ain't a tourist. You're on business,
Big Noogie reminded him, and went to change into sportsman garb he'd purchased online from Bass Pro. An hour later, somebody knocked on the door of Trabeau's hotel room. It was Juveline, wearing white short shorts and a stressed tangerine halter. She asked Trabeau if he was in the mood to be fucked into a coma. He said, totally. She kicked off her sandals and began riding him so violently that he feared his hip sockets would crack. During the tumult, a wooden slat succumbed beneath the box spring, yet somehow the bed frame remained intact.
The Sandman never lost consciousness and clearly heard Juveline say, before departing,
"Baby, you kiss like a blowfish on batteries."
For a long time, he lay there, sticky and sore, contemplating the foolishness of what he'd done. On the death wish scale of 1 to 10, screwing a mafia capo's girlfriend was like a 17. That the capo also happened to be your new business partner further magnified the risk. On a positive note, Trabeau sensed it wasn't Juveline's first foray to a stranger's bed, which meant she was experienced at deceiving Big Noogie. If she weren't a skilled cheater, Trabeau reasoned, she would already be dead. Later, he showered, shaved, and walked to a restaurant called Clippy's, glowingly recommended by the hotel's rooftop bartender. While waiting to be seated, Trabeau saw a man emerge from the women's restroom carrying an aluminum pole with a rubber snatch noose attached to one end. The maitre d' said there was a clogged pipe, which Trabeau found amusing due to the indigo stitching on the so-called plumber's shirt, Monroe County Animal Control. For wine, Trabeau selected a French Chardonnay, and for an entree, he chose poached yellowtail on a bed of quinoa. The server stopped by the table no less than a half dozen times to ask if everything was all right. It was Blister's first ride in a limousine. Giddily, he lunged for the minibar. Buck Nance used Lane Coolman's phone to call Crystal.
"Baby, I'm coming home soon," he said.
"Who's this?"
"Aw, don't be like that."
"Wait, now I remember," said his wife. "You're the scumbag husband who keeps a whore on the side."
"She's just another stalker, I swear to Christ."
"Is Miracle her real name, or is that what her pimp tagged her with?"
"She's a total psycho, Crystal. You can't believe a word she..."
The line went dead. Buck tossed the phone back to his manager. His life was a war zone. First his mistress, and now the entire family had turned against him. Crystal was the only one who had a legitimate cause for being mad. To Miracle, he'd made no promises. She knew the score. It was the disloyalty of his three brothers that was so galling. Buck had been the steering force of their careers, from Grand Funk Romberg to the Brawlers to the Brethren. Without his guidance, those ungrateful jerk-offs would still be dragging their accordions to dairy festivals, opening for the bull semen auction. Buck vowed to use his homecoming sermon at the Chickapaw Tabernacle to address, in an evangelical context, the betrayal by Junior, Buddy, and Cleroy. He told Lane Coolman to put a writer on the project ASAP. The gun on Blister's lap reminded Buck that technically he was still a captive. Blister was finishing his second Jack and Water, and he would have gulped a third had the drive to the airport not been so short. Blister fit the gun in the front of his waistband before they stepped out of the limo. The butt of the weapon was hidden by the white guayabera that Coolman had bought for Blister so he wouldn't look like some vagrant meth head loitering on the tarmac. Buck got suspicious when he saw the plane taxi to a stop. It wasn't the jade-striped Gulfstream that platinum artists usually sent. This jet was somewhat smaller and flat gray in color. Blister, however, was impressed. He tried to snap a picture with his phone, but the battery had croaked. The person who walked off of the aircraft was not John David Ampergroat, another unsettling surprise for Buck. Coolman introduced the traveler as Cree Windsor, a senior vice president of Platinum.
"This is Spyro Nance," Coolman said to Cree Windsor.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Spyro. I've heard good things."
Cree Windsor held out his right hand, which Blister eyed as if it were a steaming cow pie.
"So you ain't the main man?" Mr. Ampergrout really wanted to come, but unfortunately a personal matter came up at the last minute. He sent me instead with his regrets. I brought the latest draft of the terms we'll be presenting to the network.
Cree Windsor brandished an oxblood briefcase as evidence of his authority.
What kind of personal matter? Blister asked. Deaths in the family?
Cree Windsor glanced at Kuhlman for backup and said,
Well, yes, sadly.
Was it his mama or daddy that passed?
I believe it was an aunt.
Blister said,
That ain't good enough. He ought to be here, goddammit.
Mr. Ampergroat and his aunt were extremely close.
You mean they was, like, doing it?
What? No.
Short, trim, and soft-shouldered, Cree Windsor was preternaturally pale due to an exotic melanin imbalance that defied all tanning sprays. Often, he had a hard time convincing clients that he lived in Southern California. Kuhlman assured Blister that Mr. Windsor was a major player at the agency, Amp's second in command. Blister stomped around in a huff, but nobody heard what he was muttering because a 737 was rolling down the main runway. When it was quiet again, Buck Nance asked Cree Windsor to show them the paperwork Amp had sent.
Is your lawyer here to review it?
Cree Windsor asked.
Not yet. Kuhlman interjected. I'll do the first pass.
Blister fidgeted.
But this dude ain't even the top man.
Cree Windsor balanced the briefcase on one knee and took out a 3-page letter, which he handed to Kuhlman.
What's the story with your hair?
Blister demanded.
Cree Windsor was rattled. I'm not sure what you mean.
It don't move.
Buck saw the situation disintegrating fast.
Okay, let's chill out. The guy flew all the way across the country to get this thing done.
Windy as hell,
Blister fumed,
and not one fucking hair on his head moves.
Plaintively, from Cree Windsor,
it's just product, man.
Product? Is that the same as jizz?
Kuhlman said, Why don't we go sit in the limo where it's quiet? Have a drink while I look over these deal points. Buck said,
Liquor sounds like a damn fine idea.
I got a better one,
Blister sneered, raising his guayabera so that Cree Windsor could see the butt of the pistol.
Get back on that motherfucking airplane and go tell your boss I ain't doing business with nobody but him. Tell him hurry up and plant his dead auntie and get his ass down to Key West.
Buck felt like grabbing the gun and plugging the moron. What held him back was the fear of blowing his lucrative new network contract. Until the ink dried, Blister was Buck's negotiating leverage, his ace in the hole. Where would Buck find another phony lost twin on short notice?
Now, boys, this is getting a little crazy, Lane Kuhlman said. Let's not forget we're all on the same team.
His dedication to the agency stopped short of stepping into the potential line of fire between Blister and the shaking Cree Windsor.
I ain't crazy. All I want is respect.
Blister plucked the letter from Kuhlman's hand, dropped his pants, and wiped himself with the pages, which he then returned to Cree Windsor's briefcase.
What the fuck?
Said Buck Nance, clutching his head. Cree Windsor kicked the briefcase away and loped toward the jet.
Tell Amp we'll be waiting,
Kuhlman shouted after him. None of this nonsense was witnessed by Andrew Yancey and Mary Mansfield, because Yancey's car had been pulled over on White Street for running a red light, which Yancey agreed had been necessary to keep sight of the Cadillac limousine. Mary showed the cop one of her many driver's licenses, and he let her off with a warning and a wink. Yancey guessed that the limo had been heading to the airport, and he was correct. Unfortunately, by the time Mary pulled up to the private aviation terminal, the big black stretch was already departing.
Its tinted windows prevented Yancey from seeing that the passengers were still inside. He and Mary stood at the chain-link fence, watching a gray business jet take off, and assuming that Buck Nance, Lane Coolman, and Benny the Blister were on board. Yancey entered the terminal, where his Roach Patrol laminate failed to impress the attractive, silver-haired woman behind the desk. She pleasantly declined to tell him who owned the aircraft or where it was going. When they were back in Yancey's car, Mary said,
"Let's you and me go celebrate."
"What would be the occasion?"
"Our last night together."
"Dinner's on me," said Yancey. They stopped on Duval so Mary could buy some radical cutoffs that offered a crescent glimpse of her bumblebee tat. Yancey put on the Panama hat that he'd saved from the wreck of the wet nurse. They were walking hand in hand to Clippy's when Rogelio Burton finally called back. Yancey gave him the tail numbers of the gray jet. Having a real detective badge, Burton would have no problem obtaining the passenger list. Wherever the plane landed, cops would be waiting for Benjamin Krill. "Case closed," thought Yancey. "Back to the vermin beat for me." At the restaurant, they were personally seated by Irv Klepowski, who thanked Yancey for allowing him and the mayor to reopen. They had decided not to sue Buck Nance over the beard clippings because his talent agency had spontaneously donated $25,000 to Neil and Clippy's Butterfly Preserve in Belize. "Straight from the heart," said Yancey. "What's the pouchy situation?" Clippy said there had been no new sightings of the Gambian Goliaths on the premises.
"Not one turd, Andrew."
Yancey detected a tense hitch in the pronouncement. He ordered Barbancourt and Coke. Mary had a vodka tonic. At another table sat a light-haired, fleshy, fish-lipped fellow who was dining alone. Yancey noticed him eyeing Mary, though not in the way most men did.
"I know that guy," she said, and rolled a fingertip wave. "Hey, Martin!"
The fleshy patron turned away and called to get a server's attention.
"What's his story?" Yancey asked Mary.
"My last job. Obviously, they didn't break his kneecaps, which is huge. The people who hired me, I mean. They were heavy dudes. Poor little Marty was slow to catch on."
"So that's the driver of the second Buick you bashed?"
"He told me he deals beach sand, Andrew. He said you can call him up, order a whole freaking beach, and he delivers it on a great big boat. Who ever heard of a gig like that?"
Yancey said, "It's like printing money. I'm serious."
They watched the man named Martin pay his bill and scurry out of the restaurant. He didn't wave or say hello. Chapter 19. Rick's career track to nightclub bouncer included Purdue University's football team, the Cleveland Browns, the Oakland Raiders, and finally the Miami Dolphins. He was cut for the last time at age 31 and decided he preferred the climate of South Beach to that of Pontiac, his hometown. It had been a similar path for his friend Rod. University of Iowa, the San Diego Chargers, the Dolphins, the Atlanta Falcons, and then back to the Dolphins before blowing out a knee. Like Rick, Rod found no reason to leave Florida after his football days. Both men ended up working at a club on Collins Avenue, where they connected with a wealthy weekend customer named Brock, who said he was a lawyer. The bouncer's first freelance assignment was to terrorize a landscape architect that Brock suspected of teaching tantric techniques to his fiancée. Rick and Rod visited the man, who soon afterward shut down his nursery, moved to Clearwater, and took a job sculpting hedges for the Church of Scientology. The next time Brock contacted Rick and Rod, he asked them to go chat with the manager of a Hialeah impound lot where one of Brock's pristine Porsches had been towed. The vehicle was released after a meeting that lasted barely long enough for Rick to demonstrate the versatility of a common crowbar. A scenic drive to Big Pine Key would be the highlight of their third and final mission for the lawyer, a tune-up job for which they'd each been promised a grand. The bouncers had been sent to persuade some hard-headed fool to sell his house to Brock. They were unaware that the recalcitrant homeowner was an ex-cop, or that he might be reckless enough to take on two ex-NFL linemen whose combined weight was 525 pounds. Through no fault of their own, Rick and Rod arrived unprepared for resistance. Brock had supplied a for sale sign to plant in the homeowner's front yard, which they did. Brock had explained that the sign was meant to galvanize the man's decision-making, which made sense to Rick and Rod. Visual aids were often helpful. They were seated on the man's comfortable new sofa when a car dropped him off and sped away. The man didn't come inside right away, which should have tipped off the bouncers to trouble. In their defense, it was extremely rare for anyone, even the drunkest jerks at the club, to do anything but wilt when facing Rick and Rod in tandem. As a result, their reflexes were rusty. The man they'd been sent to rough up sneaked into his house through a rear door, sprinted yowling into the living room, and whacked Rod from behind with the for sale sign. The wood placard loudly broke apart, leaving Rod slumped unconscious, and the attacker holding the sign's sturdy metal stems, one in each fist. Rick was struggling to elevate his heft from the sofa cushions when he received the first blow. Numerous others followed. He awoke, sometime later, on the floor, his thick wrists zip-tied to those of his torpid partner. Their shiny South Beach trousers had been removed and knotted around their ankles. Rick noticed that the man who'd overpowered them was tall, though not very muscle-bound. He wondered how such a routine dude could have hit them so hard. Possibly the man was high on crystal meth or bath salts. That's what Rick intended to tell his friends at the gym when they asked what the fuck had happened to his face. The man, wearing a brimmed straw hat, said he was sick and tired of people breaking into his home. "By the way, that diamond ring you're looking for, it's gone," he said. "The first set of assholes took it."
"What diamond ring?" Rick asked. "What assholes?"
"Wise guys from up north. They were pros, not like you. Ask Brad about them," the man said, "when you call him from jail."
"You mean Brock?"
"Tell him my house isn't for sale and he needs to get over it." Rod awoke to the wail of approaching sirens and lifted his blood-caked head.
"You called the law?"
"Paramedics, too." Rick said,
"What for? Shit, we're not hurt."
Then,
"You didn't hurt us. No way."
"Your friend is bleeding from the ears."
"One ear. Big fucking deal."
The sheriff's cars got there first, followed by a pair of ambulances. Rick and Rod were examined, EKG'd, bandaged, cuffed, questioned, and gang-hoisted onto stretchers. As they were being lugged out of the house, a Subaru sedan squealed to a stop out front. The driver was a tall, breezy redhead in short, short jeans.
"Andrew!"
she cried, running toward the man who'd just tuned up Rick and Rod. The man's shirt was unbuttoned, and he was peeling a funky wrap of bandages from his midsection. The redhead kissed him so hard that she knocked off his hat.
"Wow," she said. "I thought you were dinner, but you were the show."
The woman stood on her toes, exposing a vivid bug tattoo beneath her cutoffs on the creamy curve of her ass. Rick fantasized about it all the way to the hospital, where he faded warmly into darkness following a jumbo dose of Demerol. Rod was already laid out inside an MRI tube, dozing through a scan of his jolted brain. 8 hours later, both men were wide awake and eating breakfast, the only inmates in the medical wing of the Stock Island Detention Center. Together, they invented an exculpatory version of the night's events to tell Brock. The other topic of discussion was their NFL retirement package, specifically whether or not the league's insurance plan covered injuries sustained while committing a felony. Benjamin Krill grew up in Palatka, on the St. John's River in northern Florida. His mother attributed his lawless misbehavior to breathing fumes from the local pulp mills, though Benny's siblings had inhaled the same rancid air and grown up to be productive citizens with legitimate jobs. In fact, his brother worked deep inside the plant that manufactured scented maxi pads, and he was healthy as a boar hog. Benny's sister owned a bridal boutique and was a prodigy at Pinochle. Benny, the eldest, was incarcerated regularly and, upon being freed, would promptly resume stealing until he got caught again. This had gone on for 27 years, in jurisdictions stretching from Jacksonville to Naples. Benny had been tagged with the nickname Blister after backing into a pot of hot chowder while burglarizing the kitchen of a homeless shelter in New Smyrna. His parboiled, abscessed buttocks had drawn raucous and mostly unwelcome attention in the showers at the Volusia County lockup, and from then on, Blister was listed as a primary AKA on his rap sheet. The judge in the New Smyrna case, unmoved by the defendant's second-degree disfigurement, slapped him with 18 months. Like many career criminals, Benny Krill suffered from a deficiency of ambition that left him content in midlife to be slim-jimming cars and looting mobile homes. That is, until the night he went to see Buck Nance's show at the Parched Pirate. When his idol bolted in panic from the bar that night, Blister's only thought was to rescue Buck and comfort him. It had turned into a kidnapping only after Buck acted surly and unappreciative. His claim that he and his brothers were actually accordion players from Wisconsin was so lame that Blister felt insulted. He and Captain Cock were plainly cut from the same deep southern cloth. Why would the man deny it? And why the hell would he hide his Cajun accent? What was he ashamed of? Equally upsetting was Buck's apathetic response to Blister's tribute tattoos and treasured collection of Nance-feathered trout flies. The disavowing attitude displayed by the leader of the Nances disappointed Blister and gave rise to the boldest criminal scheme ever to spring from his stunted imagination. He would trade his two high-value hostages, Buck and Buck's manager, for a role on Bayou Brethren as a newfound Nance brother named Spyro. For all its daring, the plan was also laughably, fatally absurd. Later, his mother would tell reporters that it proved she was right about living downwind from the paper mills. All those toxic vapors obviously stewed poor Benny's brain cells. A goddamn squirrel had more sense.
"This is a cool-ass ride,"
Blister commented, lounging in the back of the Cadillac limousine. Buck Nance said, "You shouldn't have chased off Mr. Windsor. That wasn't too bright."
"Is that how you talk to the man with the gun?"
"That's how I talk to the man that just wiped his ass with my future." Lane Coolman told them both to chill.
"I left a message for Amp telling him to get here as soon as possible. Long as we stick together, we'll nail this deal. But if you guys keep stomping each other's nuts, it's game over. Amp will tell you the same thing. These network people can smell weakness."
"Know what I smell?" Buck said. "I smell that fucking briefcase in the trunk." Not even Coolman had volunteered to wipe the shit off Cree Windsor's letter so they could review the terms of the contract proposal. Blister said,
"Don't you boys forget, I'm the only one here ever killed a ISIS."
Kuhlman advised him to never again mention what happened on the Conk train. "We need a new ride," Buck said grimly. The black stretch Cadillac was drawing stares at every intersection. Blister seemed to be enjoying the attention. Kuhlman was glued to his cell, rereading a text from Smeg, his divorce lawyer. Rachel's team had told the judge that her husband skipped town. She was demanding a contempt order and an arrest warrant.
"I'm in deep shit back home,"
Kuhlman fretted, to no one in particular. Blister cackled as he snatched another Jack Daniels miniature from the limo's minibar, illuminated by an inset string of violet LEDs.
"This car's a total pussy magnet," he said. "Let's just drive round and see what happens."
Buck stared at this degenerate ambassador for his own popularity, wondering how many other Brethren fans were homicidal nutjob stalkers. "Maybe it's time to quit the show and go fishing," he thought for the first time since Blister had removed his handcuffs. "Dump the family. Move into the condo with Miracle." He wasn't sure how much money he had in the bank. 5-6 million bucks? Crystal would grab half, but so be it. An unhurried, unexamined existence looked pretty sweet to Buck. A life free from soggy collard greens, rooster shit, and all those fucking TV cameras in his face. He heard Blister Krill tell the limo driver to stop the car.
"I gotta piss!"
The driver, a Cuban man with salt and pepper hair, began looking for a gas station.
"No, man, pull over now," Blister told him. "I can't hold it no more."
They ended up on a narrow street, the limo pulling over in front of a plain one-story house with Bahama shutters. From the outside,